Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm John Norton Moore, the chairman of the Center for National Security Law. And on behalf of the Center and the John Bassett Moore Society of International Law, the University of Virginia School of Law, and the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School of the U.S. Army, I would like to welcome you to this forum on the global war on terrorism, defining the roles of law enforcement and military force. Prior to the 9/11 attacks, a core thrust of the war on terror was that of law enforcement and the criminal justice system, though obviously our intelligence and our military were also engaged. Subsequent to 9/11 and a higher profile, quote, war on terror, end quote, there has been a much expanded military role. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq provide important examples. Thus, after 9/11, we have had to come to grips more effectively with the reality of both criminal justice system and military warfighting components of the national effort to control terror. Now, some changes have been almost immediate, even if they were overdue at the time. For example, breaking down the wall of separation between the FBI and the intelligence agencies concerning domestic anti-terror efforts. We also see continuing reorganization reflecting some of the changes, such as creation of the Department of Homeland Security, creation within the military of the Northern Command, and reorganization of intelligence, community, and intelligence issues. In other areas, however, we are still feeling our way in meeting new and difficult challenges as we use both of these roles in important ways. Perhaps the central core of the problems here have involved a broad range of issues concerning the question of detainees and the treatment of detainees. Those issues have ended up causing great public concern surrounding Abu Ghraib, for example. They are issues that have spilled over into the courts. We've had continuing debates about the process at Guantanamo and the efforts there and many other issues. Indeed, if we were to look at the full range of issues concerning detainees, it would include who should be detained, what are the legal mechanisms for holding detainees, what is the mechanism for reviewing such decisions, who has a right to counsel and under what circumstances? Who has a right to habeas corpus and access to the judiciary, particularly for judicial review of some of these decisions? What are the conditions for detention? What are the rules for interrogation? What are the mechanisms for sharing and coordinating interrogation between military intelligence and law enforcement interest? What is the end game? Are we in a process in which, under a military Geneva Convention model, at some point, whenever that may be, though rather vague now, individuals will all simply be released at, quote, the end of the war? Or is it more like a criminal justice model in which individuals who are engaged in efforts to kill Americans and to blow up buildings in this country will in fact go to jail? Should we use different regimes based on whether a detainee, for example, is picked up on the battlefield or whether a detainee is picked up elsewhere? What should be the respective roles of the Congress of the United States, the President, and indeed even the courts in sorting all of this out? Now, as we turn to this very distinguished panel to try to resolve these issues, Let me also leave in front of you three fundamental points, it seems to me, that we need to keep in mind in trying to sort all of this out. The first is that in the past we have seen from time to time, sadly, that in wartime our country has sometimes crossed the line in relation to our own fundamental values and the protection of civil liberties and civil rights. The 1798 Alien and Sedition Laws and the 1918 Sedition Act come to mind in relation to interference with First Amendment freedoms. Perhaps much more seriously, even the 1942 World War II effort that picked up and incarcerated loyal Japanese Americans simply on the theory that because they had Japanese ancestry, they were somehow suspect. Something, by the way, we know actually was countered to the serious investigation that had been done about the issue by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the military itself. Now, this has to be a critical issue as we think about resolving these problems. Similarly, a second issue is we have learned quite apart simply from the question of civil liberties and civil rights, and even from our own commitment to human rights, that there is a very important principle in effective warfighting for democracies, and that is they must comply with the laws of war and human rights. We have learned in a very costly fashion from certain activities in Vietnam, such as the My Lai massacre, or even some of the problems of the Contras in relation to Central America, that when there are serious allegations of human rights problems, the harm to effective warfighting of the United States is extremely high. I believe that we've all seen the cost that has been paid for the mistakes made leading to Abu Ghraib, for example, in relation to the current setting. We must never forget, particularly, that in the war on terror, a central front is a political struggle, a political ideological struggle. The United States of America must engage fully, not only in the effective warfighting and military and criminal justice system, but we have to do it in a way that will, in fact, enhance the number of allies we have around the world in this, the number of support we have, and to isolate those extremists that are going to turn into suicide bombers. I might add on this as well that one of the paradoxes here is that the United States military had led the world after Vietnam in developing training in human rights and the laws of war and really fundamentally understanding the right way to go about it. Indeed, Colonel Graham, who is here tonight on the panel, was one of the real leaders in the United States in that movement that I have no doubt placed the United States and its military absolutely in the forefront of all such training and all such efforts of every single army in the world. And yet, somehow, something went wrong here overriding military advice and failing to listen to military judgment on those issues. And finally, there is also a third critical factor, protecting the American people against brutal terror attacks requires effective war fighting and effective application of the criminal justice system. This also is a critical need. And as a result, there may be settings where we do have to achieve accommodations with some of the other goals. And so it is the overall that we have to have in front of us as we try to answer these questions for the future. Now, let me also suggest that we are not here this evening to play the blame games. We have instead, I believe, probably the most knowledgeable panel that has ever been put together to think about these issues to look toward the future and say, how do we do it better in the overall war against terror? In essence, we need to learn from the difficulties we have had. Perhaps we should follow the great quote of Winston Churchill on this, that a pessimist sees the difficulty in every opportunity, an optimist sees the opportunity in every difficulty. I would call on our panel to be optimist tonight, because that's really what we seek to do in looking at this for the future. Now, our first panelist is Colonel David E. Graham, who is the Executive Director of the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School of the U.S. Army. Colonel Graham served from 1994 to 2002 as the Chief of the International and Operational Law Division in the Office of the Judge Advocate General, Department of the Army. And from 1993 to 1994, he served as the Chief Strategic Planning Office of the Judge Advocate General in Department of the Army. I believe that Colonel Graham is the leading expert on the law of war and on thinking about these issues in a broad sense of anyone in the United States. And I salute him for the extraordinary leadership that he provided in leading toward effective training and the creation of the whole field of operational law in the United States Army. Please join me in welcoming David Graham.
Well, thank you, Professor Moore, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's certainly a pleasure to be here this evening. I appreciate the opportunity of being with you and serving on this panel. Let me preface my comments with the assurance that I appear here in a very personal and private capacity. I do not purport to represent the views of the Department of Defense, the Department of the Army, or the Army's Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School, your neighbor right across the street. And let me say also, as always, Professor Moore has very clearly and succinctly framed the evening's topic, defining the appropriate roles to be played by the use of military force on the one hand and conventional law enforcement activities on the other in conducting what has consistently been referred to by this administration as, quote, the global war on terrorism. In examining the issue of the appropriate balance between these two components, however, the use of force and law enforcement, I would suggest that any decision made with respect to this balance will be significantly affected by whether one views the ongoing U.S. response to 21st century terrorism as a true war. And I mean by that a war from a purely legal perspective as opposed to a political perspective. And I say this because I think that the approach that one takes toward this very basic but fundamentally important issue will again very significantly impact what one views as the extent to which and the manner in which the currently existing international and U.S. domestic law can be applied for the resolution of the numerous legal issues that have been in play since 9/11. And of course, at the very core of this issue is the question of whether the President has in fact been imbued with the full range, the full panoply of war-making powers and authority under his constitutional authority as Commander-in-Chief. That's a very important factor impacting on this entire issue. In other words, what I am posing for your consideration, ladies and gentlemen, this evening, is that any decision made with respect to what one considers to be the appropriate roles to be played by the use of military force and conventional law enforcement will be driven largely, if not exclusively, by whether one and endorses the view and accepts the view that the United States is truly at war. And there are two schools of thought on the matter of whether the United States is currently engaged in a global conflict against terrorism. And I would submit to you that there are actually two schools of thought on this, not simply one school of thought. Let me very briefly outline the basic tenets of each of those schools of thought and the impact that it has on the overall issue that we discussed tonight. The first school of thought would go something like this. 9/11 has truly changed everything. 9/11 has changed our world. And let there be absolutely no doubt, the United States is at war. Use that hackneyed word, the paradigm has changed. And I think this school of thought was expressed and captured very well in the words of a former associate White House counsel in an interview conducted for Frontline, a PBS production, very recently. He had this to say about this specific issue. You have to accept the paradigm shift. That is, in fact, a matter of war. This is a matter of war, and that it calls for the exercise of the president's powers as commander-in-chief and a military response, rather than a matter of law enforcement that calls for an exercise of the president's powers as the nation's chief law enforcement officer. Once you appreciate and understand that this is, in fact, an existential threat to our government, to our way of life, that it is a military conflict, even if of an unconventional character, the answers to a lot of these questions become very clear. So, given the fact of this new kind of war and the novelty of this threat to national security, the legal issues associated with this threat are themselves unique, highly complex, heavily nuanced. So this school of thought would say that the old law, the old rules simply do not work. They do not enable us being the United States, to achieve the results that we absolutely must achieve in order to win this unmistakable war. Therefore, what we must do, they would say, is to shape the old law, shape the old rules in ways that enable us to effectively and efficiently deal with these novel issues. Alternatively, they would say we must look to the establishment of new law and new rules to enable us to win this war. And again, let's turn to the words of that former associate White House counsel as he speaks to this particular matter. There was a group of people, a group of lawyers in the executive branch who really were the political appointees most directly accountable to the president, who understood this new threat, who understood the new paradigm, who understood the imperative to be forward-leaning and to be aggressive in trying to protect American national security. And then there were other people who were imprisoned in old categories, old rules, who hadn't fully made the transition, made the shift into accepting acts of catastrophic mass casualty terrorism as true acts of war that really did call for a military response and call upon the president's powers as commander-in-chief. There are things that lay within the outer margins of the president's authority that for a host of reasons over the years simply hadn't been done. But in the new environment, with the new attitude, we were now absolutely determined to do just that. And I think that's probably a very clear expression of something that we call the unitary executive. And so this school of thought would say that any assessment of the appropriate mix of the use of military force and law enforcement actions must be accomplished, must be adjudged in this specific context. In the context of the fact that we truly are engaged in a new kind of, but nevertheless, a very real war. That's the first school of thought. Second school of thought would go along these lines. They would look you in the eye and they would say, the existing international and domestic law are quite sufficient to deal with the various legal issues that have been at play since 9/11. Now, why do they say that? I think they'd begin by taking a look at the term global war on terrorism itself. And again, they would look at you and say, global war on terrorism. It's a nice soundbite. Makes for high political theater. The media loves it. But if you view it from a purely legal as opposed to a political perspective, it is simply hyperbolic fiction. It's right up there with the war on drugs and the war on poverty. Now, what's their reasoning behind that? I think that they would say that if you truly mean to send a message to the international community that the United States is engaged in a global war on terrorism, in general, what you're saying to the international community is that the President of the United States, acting undoubtedly unilaterally, will deploy U.S. combat forces across any international boundary or boundaries, with or without the consent of the states involved, to engage in combatant activity against any terrorist organization, regardless of the cause purported by that terrorist organization. And then I think they would say and think not only of the jus in bello issues associated with that particular approach, think of the jus ad bellum issues, not the least of which is the effect that this would have on the very bedrock of our nation state system, the concept of sovereignty. And so I think that they would say, don't talk to us about a UN Security Council resolution or a congressional resolution that authorizes the use of force following 9/11. That simply doesn't serve as a blank check, as carte blanche for the President of the United States to engage in a battle against terrorism around the world. They'd move on then, and I think they would say, rather than thinking in terms of and approaching legal issues from the standpoint of a war on terrorism writ large, the U.S. must instead focus on the most effective use of an appropriate mix of both military force and law enforcement, actions that deal with the threat to national security posed by al-Qaeda, not terrorism in general. I think they would say that if approached in this manner, the existing international law, to include specifically the law of armed conflict, is sufficient to address the use of force legal issues, i.e. those issues arising in the context of military action taken against states that sponsor or support attacks against the United States, or against those states that simply harbor individuals who engage in such attacks. And then I think they would move on to say that the existing federal law, the law that impacts on law enforcement, the law that implements statutorily the various international conventions that deal specifically with forms of terrorism, are quite sufficient to deal with acts that are truly terroristic in nature, vice actions that might legitimately be deemed to constitute an armed attack against the United States, or in this case, an unlawful belligerency engaged in by unlawful combatants. In other words, they would say that if you would simply abandon the idea that we are at war against terrorism in general, a legal fiction, I think, that they would say, that has led to legal theories that are themselves more fictional than factual, we could have approached in a very coherent, a very focused manner, the legal issues that have arisen since 9/11. And I think they'd tick off a few of these issues, the first of which would probably be the applicability of the law of armed conflict in general, the Geneva Conventions in particular, to U.S. military operations abroad, regardless of how we characterize those military operations. And secondly, the status determination of individuals captured on the battlefield by individuals taken into custody on the streets of Chicago. Thirdly, very importantly to our topic this evening, the appropriate prosecutorial forum for individuals who engage in acts of terrorism by those who function as unlawful combatants on the battlefield. And of course, inherent in all of these issues is the necessity to distinguish between terrorists engaged in acts of terrorism and unlawful combatants who engage in an unlawful belligerency against the United States. And then finally, I think that they would say, amongst other legal issues, the appropriate standard of treatment for not only prisoners of war, but all categories of detainees. And finally, and very importantly, the lawful interrogation techniques applicable to not only prisoners of war, but again, all of the categories of U.S. detainees. I'd conclude by simply mentioning that as I attend and participate in international conferences, I've had numerous foreign colleagues, many of whom I've known for years, speak to the U.S. contention that 9/11 changed the world, and thus the international law applicable to that world. And they constantly remind me that the only thing new about our, i.e. the U.S. world, is that the United States has finally been hit by a horrific and confidence-shaking act of terrorism, something they remind me that the rest of the world has been dealing with for decades. This, they say, does not entitle the United States to dismiss what they consider to be the old law, declare war on a phenomenon that has no agreed international definition, and invent what they view as a largely self-serving, unilaterally mandated set of rules on the international community. I think a fairly succinct explanation of what's now referred to as American exceptionalism. Rather than a new world, they insist on telling me the United States has finally been introduced to the real world. Now, as I've noted previously, and I've repeated this theme a couple of times, the difference of opinion on the issue of whether the United States is truly at war will very significantly impact the manner in which decision makers will define the appropriate roles of law enforcement and military force in confronting 21st century terrorism. I ask that you, ladies and gentlemen, keep this thought in mind during the course of this evening's panel discussion and the ramifications that flow from that thought. I thank you for your attention.
Our next panelist is M.E. Spike Bowman, who currently serves in the Senior Executive Service as Senior Counsel on National Security Law at the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He is a former intelligence officer and specialist in national security law with extensive experience in espionage and terrorism investigations. In addition to national security experience, he is a retired United States Navy captain who served as head of international law at the Naval War College and as a diplomat at the U.S. Embassy in Rome, Italy, and chief of litigation for the United States Navy. Let me just say also that it has been my pleasure to observe the career of Spike Bowman for many years. In my judgment, he is the top national security law expert in the Justice Department and in the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He has performed invaluable service to the United States of America, and it is a very, very special privilege and pleasure to welcome Spike Bowman to this audience. Please join me in welcome.
Thank you, John. The reason he says such nice things about me is he was one of my instructors one time. So, like Dave, I have to say that my comments here are personal. I really don't have to, I suppose. Director Mueller always disavows everything I say anyway, but they are personal. I think Dave has really set the stage here for trying to figure out exactly how the United States can, should, must, does approach what is a situation that in our history really is unique. Like Dave, I think it is far too simple to say that 9/11 simply changed everything. I think it clearly did not change everything. And there are a lot of aspects of our society that we simply don't want anything to change. And so 9/11, I think, is not going to be the catalyst for that. That said, we are engaged in a dichotomy of sorts. We do have a political struggle going on. The conflict that we are fighting is armed conflict, and like all armed conflicts, it has a political dimension to it. That's important from my point of view because I represent the law enforcement community, and the law enforcement community tries hard not to be involved in political issues. And as I go on, you'll see why this has become somewhat more difficult for us than might otherwise be the case with some issues. This is a political struggle that is really kind of unlike anything that we have been faced with in the past, because in this one, the objectives and the tactics are not as clearly defined for us as a conventional war. The tactics that are being used are non-traditional. It is not clear that anyone can win this war to the extent that, as Dave says, it is, to the extent that it's a war. And the purposes here are also different. It's not necessarily to win, it is to prevent the next terrorist act. And that is where the law enforcement community and the FBI that I work for is really focused. What is the goal? It's to prevent the next terrorist attack. It's to try and make sure that the society here remains safe. Now, how do we go about doing that? Traditionally, you think about law enforcement community as a community whose job it is to arrest somebody who's done something wrong, turn them over to the prosecutors, be the witnesses in court, put the person in jail, and go on to the next case. We don't want to throw somebody in jail for committing a terrorist act. We want to throw somebody in jail for trying to commit a terrorist act, for preparing to commit a terrorist act, for conspiring to commit a terrorist act. We don't want the act to occur. And what that means is we have to have information. Information is the clue to prevention. And without information, we're not going to prevent the next attack. Now, in some respects, that's no different from the way we normally approach our tasks. We gather information in a variety of different ways. We gather information primarily the greatest source, and perhaps the best place to get information, the most accurate, they're from human sources. And the FBI has lots and lots and lots of human sources. Some of them aren't very nice people, but they know what their compatriots are doing. They see what's happening in seedier areas of the town or in other parts of the world. And to the extent that we can persuade them to cooperate with us, to be honest with us, and yes, we do polygraph them, that's where we get our best information. What do we want? What kind of information do we want? Well, the problem with terrorism is that most of the people that we're after probably aren't in the United States. They're probably somewhere else plotting, maybe wanting to come to the United States, training others to come to the United States. But there's a lot of information about these people that is related to the United States, and there are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, the United States has the cheapest communication structure in the world. We have the free internet here in the United States. We have the money, the financial transactions in the United States are available to anybody. Now, what we want to find out, really, are telephone numbers. We want to know email accounts, bank accounts. We want to know how they transfer money. We want to know who the fundraisers are that provide them money. We want to know who the couriers are that take money to the fundraisers, or to the terrorists. And we want to know how they disperse it. We want to know what their communications hubs are like, how they communicate with each other. And that's constantly changing, because as you read in the papers, we have been breaking up Al-Qaeda cells all over the world ever since 9/11. We have wrapped up about two-thirds of what was the leadership of Al-Qaeda. And somebody always tries to fill a vacuum, but what that means is that we have to start all over again trying to figure out who the communicants are, how they're talking to each other, how they're planning, and what they're planning. How do we go about this? Like I said, we try to gather this information, and we get it in a lot of different ways. The one way we get it is interrogation. Detainees that we pick up sometimes have information. Now, sometimes they don't even know they have information. They have pieces of paper in their pocket with a telephone number on it. That is gold to a law enforcement officer. No. To the military, it's a so what item. But we send the FBI agents with the military overseas for the express purpose of exploiting the intelligence that we may pick up on the battlefield. And we have about 60 law enforcement and FBI officers specifically, and about 30 in Afghanistan and about 30 in Iraq on a constant rotation for that very purpose. We interrogate. Now let me tell you, I was, as John said, a military intelligence officer. I learned interrogation, but I'll tell you what, the FBI are the crown jewels in the world for interrogation. They understand it, they know how to do it, it's a rapport building process for us, and we get a lot of information out of people we talk to. Most people, believe it or not, talk to the FBI. Now they may not come completely clean, they may give us information trying to hide something else, but that's information too. And that works pretty well for us. But one of the things that we really had to look at with the post 9/11 period was how we were going to go about doing our normal job in a situation that was really quite different. And the first time that we encountered an issue was after the embassy bombings in Nairobi. There were people in custody there, and the Kenyans gave us license to come and question them, interrogate them in our own way. And we went over there with professional FBI interrogators, translators, and assistant U.S. attorneys. And the first thing that came to us is, well, wait a minute, we're in a different environment here. Now, when we interrogate people, we give them their rights. What are we supposed to do in this situation? You know, if you've all seen the shows on television and you read about it, these students in your crim law books, Miranda says you have a right to an attorney. Well, how do we give a right to an attorney to a person when there is no attorney available to them? That was one of the first issues that we faced. And we said, we considered, do we have to give rights at all? Maybe this is a situation where we don't have to give rights. But we also thought, you know, these people are in custody, and we may be able to bring them back to the United States, and we may be able to prosecute them. So while our most important issue here is gaining information, maybe we don't just sacrifice everything only for information. Maybe we try to preserve what we can. And so after fairly protracted discussions, we decided we will give a modified Miranda warning without the lawyer rights. When eventually we did bring those people to the United States, four people to the United States for prosecution purposes, we were challenged in court for not giving all of those rights. We explained to the court exactly what had happened, how the rights were given, what we said, and the court upheld the way we had done it based upon the circumstances of the time. So that was the first test. 9/11 changed a little bit, but not a lot as far as that goes. What about the rest of the things that we do? Well, FBI agents are trained as much as anything in preserving the rights of American citizens. And there are several ways that we train them. And we also provide guidance for them in their investigations through the Attorney General guidelines. And we have guidelines for both criminal and foreign intelligence investigations. They're fairly similar. They both have the same issues in them as far as privacy and First Amendment rights go, which are two of the most important things that are drilled into agents. I can't tell you, in the 10 years I've been at the FBI, I've had thousands of phone calls from agents worried about privacy rights or First Amendment rights. Well, the next question is, do we do things differently with the Attorney General guidelines? And to a certain extent, the answer is yes, because if you're overseas, you can't avail yourself of all of the options that you have in the United States. But to a certain extent, the answer was also no. And the answer was no because we train FBI agents for among other things, as I said, to make sure that they preserve the rights of the people they're talking to. And in the United States, we give a few more rights to U.S. persons than we do to aliens. Not many, but a few. But the basic point is, we give rights to everybody. That's part of the process of the social justice for the United States. And so the bottom line is, to the extent that we can, we have managed to preserve all of our tactics, techniques, the way we do things overseas, as well as in the same way that we do in the United States. It causes some issues. The military forces don't use the Attorney General guidelines, even the law enforcement portions of the military. And so we do things differently. It causes some interesting issues. If you are in an outlying base, we have two FBI agents with 50 to 100 or more military people, and the military want to interrogate and the FBI want to interrogate, because we do it different ways, it unintentionally tends to look like a good cop, bad cop routine if they come too close together. You know, that's something that we have to take into account. There is something that changes in that kind of dynamic, and we have to look at that. Those are just some of the things that are different for us. The bottom line comes down to, how do you handle a situation like this that we've never handled before? Is the military model the best way to go, or is a law enforcement model the best way to go? And I think the answer to that is yes. It depends on what the circumstances are. You do not want the FBI trying to be the people that protect you with force. To us, overwhelming force is 12 SWAT guys against one bad guy. You know, to the military, overwhelming force is a lot more than that. So that's one difference you want to start with, and the law enforcement agencies of anybody in the world cannot handle the types of things that the military may be called upon to handle. And that's just a fact of life. On the other hand, if you have the ability to preserve the social justice system that we have, at the same time, when adhering to the principle that prevention is the goal, then I think that's the way that our public expects the FBI to work. And the bottom line for us, for the FBI, is doesn't matter whether we're overseas or whether we're in the United States, we cannot do our job unless we have the support of the American public. We are about 24,000 strong, about 13 or 14,000 are agents, and there are almost 300 million people in the United States. We get most of our information from the public. We cannot do our job to protect you if you lose confidence in the FBI. So our goal, even in the war on terror, is to try and preserve the way that we do business because we think that's what you expect of us. Thank you.
Our final panelist is Professor Ruth Wedgwood, who is the Edward Burling Professor of International Law and Diplomacy and Director of the Program in International Law and Organization at the School for Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins. Currently, she serves on the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board and the Secretary of State's Advisory Committee on International Law. She has also served and continues to as the American member of the United Nations Human Rights Committee. She was an independent expert in The Hague for the United Nations war crimes trials and the prosecution of ethnic cleansing during the Bosnian War. She has previously been the Stockton Professor of International Law at the United States Naval War College. And she was a federal prosecutor at one point, working with Rudy Giuliani, among other things, prosecuting a Bulgarian spy who sought nuclear protocols and jailing arms smugglers to North Korea and Russia. In addition to that, she was not only the executive editor of the Yale Law Journal, but a law clerk on the United States Supreme Court. It has been a very special pleasure over the years to know Ruth. She is one of the absolute superstars today in international law. And as you can see, she has broad experience both on the warfighting national security side and thinking about national security issues, and also on the criminal justice side as a federal prosecutor. Please join me in welcoming Professor Wedgwood.
Well, thank you very much, John. I had a lovely ride out here through the Virginia countryside, so it was a great afternoon to come west. The last 4 years, I think, have been daunting and probably painful for most of us for all kinds of different reasons. First, the sense of, right after 9/11, great vulnerability, not knowing what this new kind of adversary was, how he was organized, how one could treat him in a way that was akin to the normal kind of interstate warfare or person-to-person prosecutions that you might bring. There's no real sense of what Al-Qaeda's technological capacity was, how truly catastrophic the threat might be, or whether it was simply in your Stanley Kubrick imagination to ever suppose that WMD could fall into the hands of a private actor. And there really was no, to my mind, obvious way to proceed. In law enforcement, which I was reared up from a very tender age, mother's milk to me, the general notion in a libertarian society is you react, you don't anticipate. There's no such thing as a status crime. You wait until somebody actually carries out a criminal act or is just about to, with a conspiracy or in an attempt. But even thinking bad thoughts, even planning to carry out a criminal act if you do it by yourself, is not a crime. So normally, I think you're waiting for palpable, visible signs of behavioral wrongdoing before you act. And Wade and my wayward youth, we did FBI guidelines, which drove you all nuts over there, which really tried to perhaps excessively persuade the Bureau, what they consented eventually, to only look at this kind of act-based model of enforcement, not to do domestic security investigations, really to wait and to worry deeply about potential impact upon exercise of First Amendment rights of association and speech, to really think of themselves very much as just the crime man, not just the facts man. In the case of Al-Qaeda, it didn't seem sufficient because certainly as a single monopolistic model, because the acts themselves could be so catastrophic. Again, rapes and burglaries and murders are terrible, but they only affect a handful of people. The concern after 9/11 was, what if you have an actor, a criminal actor, who has the means and the wherewithal and the intention to kill 30,000 people? How do you treat that? So that was, I think, one great startle to those of us who were reared on law enforcement, where one wouldn't act until you had already gathered proof and were you prepared to go to trial within 30 days, where the standard of proof was really perfectionistically high to 99.99%, and not all doubt, but any reasonable doubt would mean the person has a right to go free, where you would very much limit what kind of evidence you could admit at trial. No hearsay, it's the common law system, where you would appoint a lawyer at the first possible instance to protect the person. And that meant you really ordinarily couldn't prove a case from a person's own mouth, but that was the cost of having a libertarian domestic system, and the consequences seemed to be acceptable. I think after 9/11 there was some worry whether that would be a sufficient way to go in and of itself. But clearly there are some things law enforcement can't do. Law enforcement can't disrupt the training camps in Afghanistan. Law enforcement couldn't displace the Taliban regime and create a new standard for state responsibility to say that harboring a terrorist actor is itself an international delict. And that's a new standard that even the UN Security Council in Resolution 1373 signed on to and said there's a new standard of almost strict liability. You cannot have anything to do with an international terrorist group if you're a state without it having consequences for yourself. Clearly, in issues of preemption, there are limits to what law enforcement could do overseas. Law enforcement agents travel with the consent of their host government. You could send perhaps a covert intelligence agent into Saudi, but you don't send covert FBI agents into Saudi. You do it with the consent of the host. So there may be a limit on how much you can collect by way of intelligence if your only modality is law enforcement. I think in some cases, in rather visible ways, before 9/11, there was some frustration with some of the perhaps overly dainty guidelines that were imposed by the Bureau with its consent, like the very, very strict wall between law enforcement and intelligence, when the Moussaoui laptop could not be looked at because of the fear that under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, he was not visibly working for a foreign power. He was, at worst, people thought, part of a terrorist group that was self-sponsored and therefore didn't technically fall into crime. And therefore, he couldn't look at the laptop and therefore he didn't see the intelligence that was there. But my own case in point would be the argument that one might make about what we should have done in 1996 when Bin Laden was being expelled from Sudan and whether we should have tried to intercept his plane or answered the distress call from the Qatar, when they said, we have him here for refueling, where would you like us to keep him? And we said, send him to Afghanistan. On a law enforcement model, correct conclusion, no proof beyond a reasonable doubt of admissible proof that he was doing anything, I take it, or was inside at the time. But if you were thinking of it as an adversary who was bombing you, perhaps you'd reach a different conclusion. Now, what I would hasten to say in the circumstances of the present day, all of us feeling some chagrin, I think, at other events, is that choosing a law model doesn't mean it's antinomian, anything goes. Choosing a war model does not mean devil may care, anything goes. Even if one accepts the assertion that some of the older rules of the Geneva Conventions or of other interstate wars may need adaptation, it doesn't mean that you're in some kind of a devil may do what devil might want situation. International lawyers cling fervently to the Ninth Amendment of the law of war, if you will. The Ninth Amendment, for those of you who are not lawyers, as you know, is the catch-all of Bill of Rights that says the failure to enumerate any particular right in text does not mean it doesn't exist and belong to the people. Well, there's a Ninth Amendment in international law. It's called the Martens Clause, after the Tsar's legal advisor. And it says, as part of the 1907 Hague Convention, which makes it part of American treaty law, it's usually dismissed as a simple precatory phrase, but it has meaning. It says that our failure to codify specific rules for an unanticipated situation or an issue upon which we have not yet reached consensus doesn't mean you're free to do whatever you please. There still are principles of humanity and the common opinion of humanity. It sounds rather like the Declaration of Independence and its appeal to a common sensibility in the world community. But it does mean that whatever your theory of separation of powers, even if you believe in the unitary executive, nonetheless, the treaty commitment is that you will take some heed of the moral constraints and the common opinion of the rest of the international community. So I don't think that anyone should ever stylize it, certainly in a feckless way, as being a right to do whatever the hell you please if there's not a particular treaty that has highly articulated rules for a specific situation. And that's, I think, drilled into the sensibility of JAG lawyers, and it's drilled into the sensibility of lawyers in general. There's never, as law students discover at UVA, there's never a precedent exactly on point. The issue is how to reason by analogy in a way that takes account of the new fact, but doesn't dismiss the landscape of the law from prior encountered situations. So I think one can concede that there are elements of this which are like war, in the sense that you have to anticipate, potentially preempt, potentially use force in situations where law enforcement would be helpless, and yet not eschew the role of law in the course of doing that. The last 4 years have been, in a large part, hodgepodge in the sense of there being no agreed upon framework for within the U.S. Government for how to proceed. Ultimately, on the standard of some of the questions that John posed of who you catch, how you process them, what standard of proof you should show if you're going to assert a right to detain them, whether there's habeas corpus. Over time, there now is some set of procedures that say that there will be identity reviews for who you have on hand. It won't be a lawyer-driven process, but it will have some adversarial elements where certainly the person can tell their story and explain how they got on the Afghan battlefield, whether they are or are not a Kuwaiti shepherd or else a combatant. And there is, as the Supreme Court decided last June, in from the Rasul case, a right of habeas corpus, if you're held at Guantanamo to challenge them. There's also a second kind of procedure, a kind of parole release proceeding, to say that even if you were caught up in a fight, if you're a young man who has thought better of it and really posed no further threat, then there's no reason to detain you simply because some other group somewhere is going to use extra legal means of violence. That you really have to think of it as the mobilization and demobilization of each individual who's caught up in the violence of Al-Qaeda instead of a model of holding everybody forever, which I think would be seen as very unattractive by most people. On how to try cases, nobody's quite figured that out. There was the Moussaoui case where Judge Brinkema did a very earnest job, but there were great difficulties with how to use intelligence. The military commissions are now on hold for another 15 months. While the Supreme Court decides whether it will join them in the fashion that Judge Robertson did before. Military commissions have been used in the past, both in World War II and Civil War. And, the standards for courts martials have become much, much more demanding over time, and properly so. So one of the debates that's going on is whether the almost federal court, more important-like quality of good courts martials, is the only fair way to try the case. If you ask a European or an international person, for example, on issues of admissibility of evidence into the courtroom, in the Yugoslav Tribunal, the Rwanda Tribunal, the International Criminal Court in The Hague that's been newly formed, they let in any kind of evidence for what it's worth, without abandoning the idea that there always has to be sufficient evidence, and enough evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. But as to what's admissible, anything comes in. That's the rule of the commissions. It would be anathema in a common law courtroom, so the debate would be whether that's a fair way to proceed, or the different models of fairness for different kinds of courts. Some things should be utterly sacrosanct, the right to exculpatory evidence, the standard of proof that must be beyond a reasonable doubt. No one should ever degrade what it means to prove a criminal case, giving the defendant a vigorous and zealous prosecution of right of defense and assistance in this defense. But how to adapt that to trials during wartime can pose some difficulties. But I do think some of the problems in trying to create a legal framework that captures the best elements of law of war and of criminal law, partly is, dare one lament, the historical inactivity of Congress. Congress often doesn't like to be ahead of the problem. The executives, as Robert Jackson warned, didn't just predict, he warned Justice Jackson, the tools belong to the man who uses them, and if Congress doesn't take the initiative to propose alternative frameworks, the executive, which is in session 24/7, does it for them. So I think the sense of having a healthy balance of powers between the branches depends upon the willingness of those other branches to come forward and take some of the responsibility for being wrong, perhaps. It also, I think, takes a kind of educational process, perhaps. Again, federal district judges are reared for a certain set of problems. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court was formed back when? 78? 80. On the surmise by the book, the sacrosanct woman, Mary Lawton, you should set up a fellowship in her.
Yeah, that's right.
At your school. She was a wonderful intelligence doyenne with the Department of Justice from Georgetown Law School. But her view was that the world of intelligence and the world of federal judging in ordinary circumstances are quite far apart, and that it would actually take some adaptation, familiarity with a different kind of world with a different set of problems to make the FISA court work right. So she had a specialized, she put back the idea of a specialized panel. No one has proposed that yet for terrorism. One could argue that it would be a mistake because you can become very hard-bitten if you only deal with hard-fighting problems all the time. On the other hand, I think it may give you a different appreciation of some of the difficulties of proceeding in an environment, a Hobbesian environment abroad, where the other side may not play by the rules. But I do think that the sense that we've had of being put to a kind of slightly helter-skelter adaptation is because the common law system itself is particularly libertarian. The European lawyers who I've spoken to point to the fact that with the juge d'instruction, trusting a judge to conduct the investigations instead of the prosecutor, that they have been willing for quite some time to entertain impositions on liberty that we would find quite extraordinary, of allowing people to be detained for 3 years, 4 years in France and Spain while an investigation is completed, something that in the U.S., under our constitutional system, you could not do without suspending any evidence, because we believe that if you detain a person, you should be prepared to put them on trial with sufficient proof at the moment of detention, plus or minus 30 days, 60 days. So the Europeans have perhaps had an easier time of adaptation. But I think at the moment, as we're all focused, for the moment, all of our attention is not so much on these other questions as the issue of standard treatment for detainees. Clearly there are a great many international instruments that come into play here. Torture Convention, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which we have ratified under George Bush Sr., as well as standards of customary international law of war. And I'll just give a personal vignette. I've just come back from Geneva, where my other side of my brain is the Human Rights Committee, and we did examinations of Brazil. We finally had a second country report since the step down from the dictatorship. And Brazil, as portrayed to us, is a violent place. This is all concluding observations, where the police do whatever they please in the provinces. And torture is a very widespread practice, and there's utterly checked use of violence by the police. And the federal government simply floats on top with a prepared apologia for what happens at the state level. It's powerless to stop it. And clearly one wants to be in a position to issue reasonably strident suggestions to Brazil on how it ought to control its police and its misuse of lethal force and its most imperfect treatment of prisoners. One wants to be in a position to be able to make those critiques and not have them seem hypocritical. So I do think in the current debates on how we treat prisoners, that whatever technical arguments one might make about the domain of a particular treaty or a particular set of guidelines or statutes, that the problem of losing your leverage, losing your moral leverage, is one that we have to keep very much in mind. That particularly if you're a Wilsonian and you think that you can't beat something with nothing, that the only way to beat Salafist Islam and the rather hopeless outlook of unemployed young Muslim men is to give them something to be optimistic about, and that would be democracy and a chance to take part in government and have a human right to do so, that then you can't simply cut the struts out from under your own moral package. So understanding all the difficulties of collecting intelligence, understanding that this is in large part an intelligence war, what the military may call pocket litter to thieves is just gold from heaven, and that this is very much a microscopic war. But I do think that the sense that we've had of being put to a kind of slightly helter-skelter adaptation is because the common law system itself is particularly libertarian. The European lawyers who I've spoken to point to the fact that with the juge d'instruction, trusting a judge to conduct the investigations instead of the prosecutor, that they have been willing for quite some time to entertain impositions on liberty that we would find quite extraordinary, of allowing people to be detained for 3 years, 4 years in France and Spain while an investigation is completed, something that in the U.S., under our constitutional system, you could not do without suspending any evidence, because we believe that if you detain a person, you should be prepared to put them on trial with sufficient proof at the moment of detention, plus or minus 30 days, 60 days. So the Europeans perhaps have had an easier time of adaptation. But I think at the moment, as we're all focused, for the moment, all of our attention is not so much on these other questions as the issue of standard treatment for detainees. Clearly, there are a great many international instruments that come into play here. Torture Convention, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which we have ratified under George Bush Sr., as well as standards of customary international law of war. And I'll just give a personal vignette. I've just come back from Geneva, where my other side of my brain does the Human Rights Committee, and we did examinations of Brazil. We finally had a second country report since the step down from the dictatorship. And Brazil, as portrayed to us, is a violent place. This is all concluding observations, where the police do whatever they please in the provinces. And torture is a very widespread practice, and there's utterly checked use of violence by the police. And the federal government simply floats on top with a prepared apologia for what happens at the state level. It seems powerless to stop it. And clearly one wants to be in a position to issue reasonably strident suggestions to Brazil on how it ought to control its police and its misuse of lethal force and its most imperfect treatment of prisoners. One wants to be in a position to be able to make those critiques and not have them seem hypocritical. So I do think in the current debates on how we treat prisoners, that whatever technical arguments one might make about the domain of a particular treaty or a particular set of guidelines or statutes, that the problem of losing your leverage, losing your moral leverage, is one that we have to keep very much in mind. That particularly if you're a Wilsonian, and you think that you can't beat something with nothing, that the only way to beat Salafist Islam and the rather hopeless outlook of unemployed young Muslim men is to give them something to be optimistic about, and that would be democracy and a chance to take part in government and have a human right to do so, that then you can't simply cut the struts out from under your own moral package. So understanding all the difficulties of collecting intelligence, understanding that this is in large part an intelligence war, what the military may call pocket litter to thieves is, you know, just gold from heaven, and that this is very much a microscopic war. There are no kinetic artillery corps to detect from the air. We currently have oversight for the semester. The former deputy director at CIA, he's quick to point out this is a very different kind of war where you're looking for tiny objects, phone numbers, email addresses, people with 14 AKAs, aliases, who you can only identify with biometrics. It's a very different kind of task which combines the ferocity of war with the kind of microscopic fact-finding, for which we often used to prefer the postal inspectors, but we take the FBI in a pinch. But it's a wrong excuse, that's a joke. The postal inspectors were another very good agency with a high threshold for boredom and willing to sift through long bags and bags of shredded documents to put together probable cause, as the Bureau does do. But it requires a combined skill set that neither agency has in toto. But I take the point that the other two speakers have suggested, which is that to maintain one's morale for the long run, to avoid the Vietnam syndrome where you become so dispirited by the nature of the conflict that you give up and go home, which is in this case not an option, that one has to maintain a certain degree of moral self-confidence about it that requires at times some reticence. You can't quite match the ferocity of your adversary.
One of the interesting proposals that I heard from Colonel Graham is that perhaps we can differentiate the treatment and the model based on the possibility of where they are captured. For example, to use the Geneva Convention model, to use the warfighting model on all of those that are picked up on the battlefield, and to use the law enforcement model, at least as a starting point, on those that are picked up in the streets of Chicago. I would like to simply present to the panel that question. Is that a good starting point as we try to determine in dealing with detainees which of these models we have? We might then sort of pursue each of these on the two sides of the equation as to what some of the issues are. But is that a reasonable starting point? Anyone that would like to deal with it?
Well, I should probably respond to that first, since I'm the one who suggested it. And I think it is a good starting point. I'd like to simply say that John has suffered the fate tonight of every panel moderator, and that is trying to herd cats. He presented some very good questions to be answered, and obviously you're all sitting there thinking, and they didn't speak to any of those. We've got no answers, and that's what we came for tonight. And I think this is the first of a series of questions, hopefully, that will lead us down the path of offering some relatively definitive answers to the extent that we can to some of these very difficult questions. And I think it is very important to distinguish between terrorists who truly engage in terrorist actions as defined by international conventions and as statutorily implemented in our own federal criminal code, and to try and punish them as terrorists, and then to deal with unlawful combatants who are captured on the battlefield. And I do not think that we can extend unlawful combatancy and unlawful belligerency to every terrorist, and perhaps even to every Al-Qaeda member around the world when we pick them up. I think that you have to look at it on an individual basis in terms of the appropriate prosecutorial forum, in terms of how you treat them when they're incarcerated. But I think it is absolutely essential to distinguish between unlawful combatants on the one hand, terrorists on the other. And the administration has used those terms interchangeably. They've used different prosecutorial forums for each of those categories of detainees, and that's led to confusion, and rightfully so. And let me simply point out something that hasn't been mentioned here. When we're talking about this global war on terrorism, we're not talking about the war in Iraq. All right, everyone understands that that's a classic Article 2, wasn't a classic Article 2, maybe a classic Article 3 conflict now. The war in Iraq was not generated on the basis of being an essential aspect of the global war on terrorism. We went into Iraq for a different reason. So what we're talking about here is this thing that we have billed as the global war on terrorism. And as I've indicated in my remarks, I simply do not think that we can treat this as an armed conflict against terrorism in general. If we want to focus on Al-Qaeda, which is what the congressional resolution authorized in terms of the use of force, that's one thing. And then we have to decide whether we're going to treat all Al-Qaeda personnel, wherever they're taken, as unlawful combatants, as the administration has declared they are. If they're unlawful combatants, I think a military commission is an appropriate forum to try unlawful combatants. The military commission itself is not flawed. The military commission process, as it was constituted 2 or 3 years ago, was fatally flawed. And we've discovered that, painfully, over the last 2 or 3 years. But I think the military commission is an appropriate forum in which to try unlawful combatants, just as I think the federal district court is an appropriate forum to try true terrorists to engage in terrorist activities. So I'll throw that out as a beginning, John, to respond to your question.
Thank you very much. Any other thoughts or comments on the same point?
Yeah, I think it's a useful starting point, but I think you also have to take into account what we're trying to accomplish. In a traditional armed conflict, if you pick up people on the battlefield, whether they are lawful combatants or unlawful combatants, your normal process is to put them behind barbed wire, and if they are unlawful combatants, then you try them and punish them. In this case, it doesn't matter whether they're unlawful combatants or not, we want something more out of these people. And so the next question is, how do you go about getting something more out of them? Military commission, I agree with. But there's an interregnum period between the time they're picked up on the battlefield and the time they would go before a commission. And during that period of time, we want to find out if they've got information. So what's the best way to do it? And I think the best way to do it is to jam the two systems together here. If you're going to transport prisoners, who knows how to do that better than anybody else? The U.S. Marshals Service. If you're going to hold prisoners, who knows how to do that better than anybody else? That's the Bureau of Prisons. And if you're going to try and get information out of prisoners, it's the FBI. So I think you kind of need to jam these things together. One size doesn't fit all for this purpose. I don't have any problem with the military commission. I like the idea. I think that's what we ought to be doing. But we have to remember we've got another purpose in holding these people.
I think one of the difficulties, frankly, is if you think of it as an intelligence war, neither system really was designed to gather intelligence as its primary motive and purpose. Again, the criminal justice system, if you're lucky to get a confession by being charming and inveigling, terrific, but the big general premise is that you'll be prepared to proceed without it. And in normal wars, you can hope for a harvest of intelligence, but Geneva III says there are very distinct limits. No kind of coercion, psychological or physical, can be used on a prisoner, nor anything unpleasant, disadvantageous, or insulting. So I think that putting to one side the 16 techniques that are doctrinally part of the old Army Field Manual, the general thrust of Geneva III is not to try to maximize the harvest of intelligence. It may well be that we have been left in this lurch by our own complete lack of preparation, don't study Arabic, we don't study Quran, we don't study Ijtihad, we can't do a sympathetic engagement without Arabic speakers and people who know the culture. And we had 10 years to figure this out and did nothing. Often because of problems of funding, but other problems of, I think, a sense of standing down. So it's a dilemma perhaps of our own creation. But neither model really is designed to run on information from the defendant's own mouth. And in that sense, we may really have to invent either a hybrid model or a new model, which again takes account of his claims to humanity, his claims to not perhaps be convicted from his own mouth, but still give some accommodation to the public interest in having intelligence about future impending attacks. On the Al-Qaeda membership, I like Dave's suggestion, except the hard part is Quicksilver. Card-carrying Al-Qaeda, you didn't swear by God, well, reincorporate and use a different name. So if, in fact, it's an offshoot of the same group, or if you could define it functionally as, you know, a group that has boasted of its ambition to use weapons of mass destruction and its intention to attack Americans, Christian Jews, and apostate Muslims, maybe that's too inclusive. But simply what is Al-Qaeda could become a very difficult star count if you made that as the cutoff. One might have to think about the congressional authorization further, but I'm not sure that that proper name is going to give you the capture of the distinct quality of the threat that exists.
Just two final questions, because our cats have answered that so nicely. One relates to the Geneva Convention issue with respect to some allegations that we hear from time to time that the Geneva Conventions are hopelessly outmoded. Is there a sense, at least, that on the warfighting side of the equation, the Geneva Conventions are a very important and vital and living part of the models that need to be applied? Anyone like to respond to that?
I don't think there's any question about that. Obviously, having been involved in the business for 33 years, I think in terms of traditional armed conflict, the Geneva Conventions are absolutely essential. And I don't really think that anybody denies that fact, John. Going back to something that Ruth said, though, with respect to unlawful combatants, that relates to the question that you just asked. I think it's well understood that unlawful combatants, as unlawful combatants, are not entitled to POW status, and therefore the argument has been that they're not entitled to the protections of the Third Geneva Convention. And that issue played around for a long time. Well, they're not entitled to POW status, they're not entitled to the protections of the Third Geneva Convention, and so once we get over the obstacle of the 1994 torture statute, then they're fair game. And I think that simply lost sight of the fact that, as Ruth indicated in her remarks, there's a good bit of body of law out there that affords them protections and rights even though they are unlawful combatants and they're not entitled to POW status, to include the Human Rights Convention, the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights, the issue that's being hotly debated within the administration right now, the protections of Common Article 3 of the 49 Geneva Conventions, and certainly the protections afforded under Article 75 of Protocol 1, additional to the 49 Geneva Convention. So these individuals have certain rights, even though, as unlawful combatants, they're not entitled to POW protection and all of the protections that flow from the Third Geneva Convention. And then one other issue that Spike raised, and that is an issue of the principal purpose of detaining these individuals was to get good intelligence from them, and how do you marry that up with the military commission process? That's one of the fundamental issues that we wrestled with 3 years ago. We were looking in terms of military commissions or prosecutorial successes, and we understood that for successful prosecutions, even under the military commission process, there was access to counsel, there were certain rights that had to be provided, there was preservation of evidence, you had to establish an evidentiary trail. The intelligence agents were not concerned with that. And so you had competing interest. They wanted to get intelligence, they really didn't care whether we were successful in prosecuting these individuals or not. The military commission individuals were very interested in the fact that they had to follow certain rules and regulations. But again, I don't think the military commission itself is a bad vehicle. I think we have to establish a sophisticated process, and we simply didn't do that 2 or 3 years ago. But in terms of the continued relevancy of the Geneva Conventions, in my mind, that's a given, John.
I think Dave has it exactly right. I couldn't have said it better. Very good. I would like
Spike
to point
and I sit on panels together.
I probably learned it all from him anyway. A couple of things to keep in mind. That one of the reasons, one of the reasons for the Geneva Conventions is simply so that individuals going into combat understand what is expected of them from a social point of view. So from that, if nothing else, the Geneva Conventions are absolutely invaluable. They're living documents. I mean, they can add to these things, but what we've got there is there for a purpose, and it was there to sort of understand what happened in the last big war and try to regulate some of the actions that we saw there, and that's very important. One other thing I'll mention as part of the problem here, we are not able to get information from everybody, and we have picked up people that we've turned loose, a lot of people who we picked up originally. Sometimes we got them by mistake. Sometimes they were people getting rid of their enemies and turned them over and said they're bad guys. But we have turned back people because we've not found anything bad about them. We haven't learned anything bad about them. And within 10 days, found them back on the battlefield with a gun in their hand. So it's one of the problems that we have to face.
And I'll just say in a very small coda. There's no single Geneva Convention. It's a tradition. It's a kind of 150-year-old tradition from starting with the Battle of Solferino and the American side from Francis Lieber and the Civil War. So that when you speak of Geneva, it's not that. I mean, if I was doing it all over again, I'd say Third Geneva. But by the way, we're going to adjust the following articles to us. The point I take away from some of the mishaps of the last 4 years is that to an 18-year-old filled with testosterone, the word Geneva may to him be the whole package of rights. And he may not distinguish between Geneva 3, Geneva 4, Common Article 3, Torture Convention, ICCPR, nor would you, nor would most law students. I think one has to worry about law as a kind of social marker and communication of norms in large organizations and how you accomplish that. And that may have been some of the grave difficulties of the last 4 years. So one can take Third Geneva, as 29 Geneva was taken in 1945 when Nuremberg was put on, and decide that particular parts of it don't fit very well. There was a famous English lawyer, Gerald Fitzmaurice, who wound up on the International Court of Justice, who gave advice to the Brits in 45 on how you could put on the Nuremberg Convention, the Nuremberg Trials, even though it seemed that they didn't quite fit the 29 Geneva Convention. But still, it was within a range of an accessibility of humanity and basic fairness, and that, I think, is the key to preserve.
Final question is a double barrel question in pursuing prosecution under each of these strands, one the military strand and one the criminal justice strand. And the first part on the military strand is if we were to do it over again, or perhaps even do it right now in relation to setting up a structure for the military commission, should we set aside the legal debates about precisely who has the constitutional authority and seek to do it in a way that involves the Congress of the United States and the President acting together to enact a military commission structure that would perhaps be more effective than the one that's being challenged very broadly at present? And the question on the parallel side with respect to criminal justice system, given the difficulty we're having in the Musawi problems and others in prosecution, are there any kinds of changes procedurally that are constitutionally doable that we should be pursuing for the specific case or specific settings of terrorism crimes on the criminal justice side.
Well, in terms of the military commission process, I think in a perfect world you would have the cooperation of the executive branch and Congress. One of the difficult problems we've had over the last 3 years is that we've had an AWOL Congress, a Congress who has that has not been involved to the extent that they should be involved. They're entering the game now in terms of the McCain Amendment, which, as an aside, I'm professionally embarrassed as a former judge advocate and long-term DOD employee that we have to be legislatively told how we are to treat minimally afford standards of treatment to detainees, but it has come to that. I think that the military commission process initially 3 years ago was formulated on the basis not so much of affording a fair trial, but a quick trial. And I think those who made the decisions with respect to the military commission process were told that time and time again. It was an interesting juxtaposition of people in uniform mandating and attempting to mandate more procedural guarantees and due process. An interesting exercise. I think if we went back and did it again, we'd build in more efficient appellate rights, better access to counsel. Think in terms of closed sessions. There are a number of things that have been done under some enlightened leadership in the last year that have changed the rules, but we haven't moved the rules far enough, and it was a fairly difficult situation to begin with. On the criminal side of the house, I do think that those who engage in terrorist acts, who are true terrorists, as opposed to unlawful combatants subject to the military commission process, can be effectively prosecuted in federal district courts under our criminal code, but I think it may in fact take some tweaking of the criminal code. And I think that can be done. I think that we have to take a look at it in terms of more readily facilitating trials of terrorists. They're not the standard criminal. And we can take a look at that. We should be taking a look at it so that we can appropriately bring the federal district court system to bear on terrorists who truly commit terrorist acts as opposed to engaging in unlawful belligerence.
Thank you, Colonel Graham. Other panelists?
I think that Dave is perfectly correct on the part of the military commissions and also the AWOL Congress. So I'll just focus for a minute on the criminal side of the house. There are some interesting issues that come up with prosecuting terrorists and spies alike. One is the evidence that you're going to present, or actually more likely the evidence that is encompassed within discovery. It is inevitable there's going to be a lot of information that is not admissible, not relevant, and the Classified Information Procedures Act generally takes care of that. That's really not too much of a problem. We can usually handle those issues. One of the issues that has come up as in several different dimensions has been the question of the defense counsel. You know, what does the defense counsel get to see? And by the way, what does the defendant get to see? And right now, that is up to the judge as far as the defendant goes. The judges have usually been pretty good about saying that the defendant can't see this information because, but you have to give it to his defense counsel, which is fine. But then there are no real standards under which the defense counsel has to accept the responsibility of classified information. Judges have been pretty good about setting some standards. The defense counsel have usually been pretty good about handling classified information, if for no other reason than we always ask for a protective order, and you know, or lawyers don't want to violate a protective order. So it usually works out okay. But there are some gaps there that are left up to individual courts, and they are inconsistent. So there's a little bit there that we ought to do, that we ought to think about. The other is again back to the lawyer issue. One of the primary problems with Moussaoui is he keeps trying to fire his lawyers. Yeah, he doesn't want these lawyers because they all work for the great Satan, you know, and then they're Americans, so they can't be any good. And that has bogged down the trial time after time after time. And I think that we're going to have to do something to accommodate the Sixth Amendment interest in the lawyer there, because he's really just taken advantage of that to try and confound the court. Not necessarily to get away with anything. He's trying to confound the court. And There are some other issues about Misawi. His plea is a problem for the judge. I can't say anything more about that because I'm on a under a gag order. But there are several things about the Misawi case that will probably be instructive, and you know, whenever we get through this carnival.
Well, on federal court, there's been almost no conversation about this. I think, frankly, because despite all the concern about the military commissions, there's, I think, a sense that at least it's in a box. You have to be a combatant to be in the military commission. Whereas if he started mucking around with the rules of federal district court, then no telling where that would end up. There's a preference, I think, perhaps among common lawyers to keep the classical model pristine. And just create something that's quite different compartment for these other problems. I mean, if you assigned a student to write a final exam in which you would heedlessly suggest conceivable changes, then at least a B plus student might say, well, couldn't you look at changing the standards for the admissibility of evidence? And nothing wrong a priori with the European system or the international system of allowing in evidence for the weight that it should be given. The fear has always been that a jury of lay fact finders might be misled by that. But one could at least re-examine that assumption critically and see if it would land per se. Secondly, it's always been supposed that sessions have to be open to the public, even for the presentation of exquisitely sensitive evidence because of the demands of the Sixth Amendment. It may be, the student might say, an open question if Congress legislated it, whether we could close some sessions so that things were broadcast to the world. On speedy trial rights, this is an issue even with the commissions. It would be a lot easier to try cases in an utterly fulsome way if, in some sense, a particular sector of a conflict was over, so you didn't care about the operational nature of the disclosures that you were going to be asked to make. But that depends upon the demand that you go to trial right away. So I suppose the student could suggest a critical look at how you measure speedy trial rights. There could be, this is not my voice, this is my student talking, a super clearance procedure for attorneys. The general standard in federal court has been you should be allowed to pick whoever you please. Your sister, a fellow member of the XYZ movement, it's a free country. If you're worried about this kind of unobservable, conceivable misuse of exquisitely sensitive operational information, I don't know, a student might say, could we think about some kind of like super precedence, super clearance, where you could gain access to larger funds of information by having a certain kind of lawyer. And I think the point about the relationship of lawyer and counsel, both in the Milosevic trial and the Hague, where Slovo has been using the platform to fulminate, and Misawi, the sense that it's a party-driven process and the court really can't interfere with how the defense puts on its case very much, means that there's very little control over the trajectory of the courtroom. On the commissions, they would be a lot easier to run, after, if you will, the conflict quiets down. Congress could add a statutory appellate chamber. One couldn't do that administratively, but you could just plug in the Military Court of Appeals by statute. And then in any event, under Rasul, it will go to the Supreme Court for a reexamination of the jurisdiction of the commissions. And in real life, of course, look at jurisdiction, we look at the some sense of the whole package as well. But I do think it's a hard proposition to put on trials of any kind that depend upon operational information in the middle of an active conflict. And so that some of the dilemmas that are faced may not be ones that will go away easily. And I simply also finally point out that even if you bring the Congress on board, that won't settle the international law questions about whether you're obliged by treaty law to give a captured combatant the exact same modality of trial as you give to your own citizens. That treaty law question will survive any signature by Congress. So certainly having more branches on board, as Justice Jackson wisely instructed us, gives you a greater plenitude of powers, but it doesn't necessarily rid you of your international responsibility.
John, let me speak to that last issue, because When Ruth says that the question remains as to whether you have to give combatants the same due process, the same trial that you would have to give your armed forces, that's precisely the reason that the administration made the decision that these individuals at Guantanamo, subject to trial by a military commission, are unlawful combatants as opposed to POWs. If we afforded them the POW status, they would have to be tried pursuant to Articles 84 and 102 of the Third Convention by our court-martial system under our Uniform Code of Military Justice. Because they're not POWs, they can be tried by military commission. They're unlawful combatants. Unlawful combatants, they're combatants, Ruth, but they're unlawful combatants, and therefore not entitled to all the protections of the treaties that you might speak to would afford them. And we need to keep that distinction in mind, okay?
So I just final. Clearly, whatever one's own view, a defense counsel will always say that this is an invented category. Congress invented it; it's still invented. So some of these issues on international entitlements aren't going to be diverted quite so simply as we might have Congress.
The forum is now open for questions from the audience, and if you could just state your name and hopefully address your question to one or more members of the panel. Who would like to go first? Yes, sir.
Sean Watts from the Army JAC school next door. It's been suggested a number of times on the panel that what's going on, perhaps, as we approach this debate, is the creation of a hybrid legal system, something that might borrow from each of these traditions, law enforcement and law of armed conflict. But does it appear to either of the or any of the panelists that there's an amount of cherry picking going on, that each system, law enforcement and law of armed conflict, has both authorities yet also attendant responsibilities and obligations, and at least on the law of armed conflict side, that sometimes what appears to be happening is we're saying, look, we like the authorities, we like indefinite detention that's attendant to POW status, we're not so fond as Professor Wedgwood mentioned, of the attendant restrictions on interrogation that are found in both the Third and Fourth Convention. With respect to use of force, we like the use of status-based targeting, the fact that we'll shoot a person not based on their conduct or that they present a threat to the people trying to apprehend them, rather we shoot them merely because of who they are. But we don't like what's attendant in the law of war to status-based targeting, that is combatant immunity. Are we, rather than picking a system, are we picking from systems?
Yeah, I think we are, and I'm not sure that there's any reason we shouldn't be doing that. We are a society that is a little bit bound in our approach to law enforcement, at least, and I think socially by our approach to war fighting as well. We always like to do things the same as last time because we know what it is. We know what we're doing. But we aren't in a situation which is the same as last time. And if you're a lawyer, you want to argue your case by analogy. It's going to be like something else that we've done. It's going to be like the thing we saw before. It's going to be like that other case, and therefore it should go out the same way this time. We don't have anything like before. And it may be that we shouldn't be cherry-picking. Maybe we should be inventing another system. But at the moment, the only thing we can do is cherry-pick because we've got what we've got. You know, we've come to this conflict with the tools that we have. As Ruth has quite aptly pointed out, we should have been doing something a little different 10 years ago. We didn't, so we are where we are. And I think that cherry-picking is probably the right thing to do because at least you can equate the responsibilities with the authorities.
Other comments on them?
Well, I'd like to first say that Sean Watts is a ringer because he teaches international operational law over at the school. But I think he makes a good point. I think that in many instances, and I hate to pick on the administration, but I will pick on the administration. The administration has attempted to have its cake and eat it too. In one case, if they think the prosecution will go well, the individual is a terrorist. In another case, if they think the prosecution might be facilitated by military commission, the individual is an unlawful combatant. That's why I hearken back to my thesis. I think a lot of the confusion that has been rampant over the last 3 years has been self-inflicted. We've done this to ourselves. It hasn't had to be this confusing. if we could simply distinguish between who these guys are as true terrorists and who they are as unlawful combatants on the battlefield and approach it that way, we wouldn't have to engage in the cherry picking, either from the prosecutorial standpoint, the targeting standpoint, or anything else. And I'll leave it at that.
Let me just follow up on that for a moment, because there are really two very different approaches. One would say that inevitably you are going to be creating something that is a sui generis system with some cherry picking one way or the other. The other is perhaps that in fact we do have two separate systems, and the question is the clear application of those systems right now and making a determination. This doesn't go to the question of what the administration may or may not have been doing, but it goes to the question of really where you ought to draw those lines as you look at it for the future. And just for example, on the law enforcement side, certainly no one is suggesting on that side that you go to status-based targeting, for example. So is there anything really cherry-picking on the law enforcement side other than perhaps looking at some accommodations perhaps on the procedural issues in relation to prosecution? And I guess similarly, are there some things on the other side of the equation that are consistent across the board with basic principles of war fighting and full law of war tradition that would not necessarily involve cherry picking on that side? But in any event, I don't pretend to answer those, but just to suggest there are some there's very clear different answers, at least, that are on the table at this point. Any other comments on that?
I'd just like to distinguish between formal legality and kind of substantive legality. I mean, one can make anything that one wants to do with detention formally legal by suspending habeas corpus, and then the President of the United States, if he has gotten Congress's consent to the suspension of habeas, at least by traditional American law, can lock anybody up for being
Abraham Lincoln rather discovered that, didn't he?
Can't march his troops through Baltimore, he's going to lock up.
There's legislation on the table right now.
Sympathizers in Baltimore. So you can have formal legality, but that's not a sufficient answer. What you want to preserve is the, well, A number one, my little committee in Geneva says that, in fact, there are limits to how you can suspend habeas even in a state of emergency. The right to a lawyer may be fundamental. But number two, just as a moral matter, as a kind of matter of constitutional culture, the object is not to have some formal legality, but something that preserves as much of the richness of your tradition of process as you can. What I worry about, maybe I'm a little more beguiled or a little more forgiving than David. I think a lot of the heterogeneity of treatment of cases in the last couple of years, in part, there was a desire on the part of Justice, Department of Justice, to prove that criminal prosecutions could work, that Richard Reed could be convicted from his own math, that Massawi could be convicted based upon circumstantial evidence. And it really has been a kind of learning process, just like we did way back when with the motions in limine and the Classified Information Procedures Act, when nobody thought we could try Campillates without blowing the crown jewels. So it was an attempt to do some procedural adaptation, but it's proven to be harder than folks thought it would be. Where the battlefield is, that's often going to be the rub. Again, battlefields can be at home, as it was in the Civil War. The hardest case, I suppose, would be if you had somebody, put Padilla on side, there's a notional person who was on his way to mount an attack with a weapon in his hand, and he's going to attack in 10 minutes, but for some reason the criminal case can't be made because you haven't got proof beyond reasonable doubt, but you had very, very strong proof, say to 70-80% standard of certainty, what would you do? The 19th century answer, because we forget how libertarian we are compared to them, in the town selectmen in the 19th century would take people who'd been acquitted of disorderly conduct and still bind them over to good behavior upon bail or their own cognizance. We have a much more libertarian model now, so it's harder for us to think this through, but one of the problems is going to be that the place of apprehension doesn't necessarily correlate with the gravity of the immediate threat that's posed by the person.
We have about another 12 minutes. We can take a few questions. Yes, sir.
This is Mark Wentz. I'm a first year here at the university, and it's a follow-up question for Colonel Graham.
You had said that you believe military commissions are a lawful form for battlefield captures, with how you labeled unlawful combatants. And I just had a question. Isn't labeling that group unlawful combatants violative of the principle that you should be innocent until you're proven guilty? We've decided they're unlawful combatants because they don't fit within the Third Convention's Article 4, which, if they're decided to be civilians, that means on the battlefield they're murdering people. If they're combatants, that's perfidious behavior. And assuming there is any military commission trial, they'd be tried for perfidy or murder. So by saying that they don't fall under the convention because of their behavior, aren't we already finding them guilty before the trial?
Well, I appreciate the question. I think in terms of defining someone as an unlawful combatant, you have to take a look, as you mentioned, at Article 4 of the Third Geneva Convention, 4A1, 4A2, and make a determination as to whether they fall under either 4A1 or 4A2, and if they do, they're a lawful combatant. If they don't, they're an unlawful combatant. That's basic international law as opposed to predetermining guilt. It is a violation of customary international law to engage in an unlawful belligerency against a sovereign state, and those who do that are unlawful combatants. But I'm not saying that as an unlawful combatant, they have been judged guilty for any specific crime. One of the issues that the military commission process has had to face is that can you subject an unlawful combatant to the military commission process and simply prosecute them for engaging in unlawful combatancy as opposed to a specific violation of the law of armed conflict? And the threshold question becomes, yes, unlawful combatancy is a per se violation of customary international law. But I don't think in declaring them to be unlawful combatants, you're prejudging them as guilty of any specific violation of the law of armed conflict. That's to follow. Okay.
If I could just note also, as was noted in the Circuit Court opinion that written by Ray Randolph and joined by John Roberts, at the military commission trial, would be, if you will, defining anew of unlawful combatancy. I mean, it would be an interesting question. Does the military commission have to follow the president's interpretation of the elements of unlawful combatancy? Interesting question. But the kind of standard of evidence for an initial determination, whether it's an Article 5 hearing under Third Geneva or an identity hearing under the Combatant Status Review Tribunals, say it's preponderance. Clearly, the proof at trial is beyond reasonable doubt, and there'll be some finding. I'm not sure if it's decided by what standard, but the military commission itself would re-examine the issue of the status, where the status is a predicate of the crime.
And there's a follow-on issue associated with that that you often hear in the international community now, and that is that in order to determine someone as an unlawful combatant, you have to conduct Article 5 tribunals. And I've disagreed with the Justice Department and the Office of Legal Counsel on any number of things, Lord knows, over the last 2 or 3 years. But I think with respect to that particular argument, if you take a look at Article 5, it begins, should any doubt arise as to the status. Now, you have to ask the question, where does that doubt have to arise? It has to arise, obviously, in the mind of the capturing power. The mind of the capturing power, in this case, is embodied by the President of the United States, who, acting on the advice of his advisors, has determined that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were unlawful combatants because they did not meet the requirements of 41 or 42. But the doubt has to arise in the mind of the capturing power, not in the mind of the ICRC, not in the mind of Human Rights First, not in the mind of the collective international psyche. It has to arise in the mind of the capturing power. And you can argue with respect to whether it was a good determination, but there is absolutely no doubt in anybody's mind that this president was fully and firmly convinced that Al-Qaeda and Taliban personnel were unlawful combatants. That ends the debate, as far as I'm concerned, with respect to the requirement for Article 5 tribunals.
I might add to that that the issue that you've raised is not altogether different from a fairly normal issue before courts, and that is a court deciding whether it has jurisdiction based on a particular set of facts that also will go to the normative problem. For example, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and the way it operates as to whether you're within an exception to immunity or not, which is jurisdictional before the court. We have about another 7 minutes. Yes, sir, back here.
Paul Barton, I'm on exchange here at the UVA Law School from the University of Melbourne in Australia. My question is probably directed towards Mr. Bowman and Ms. Wedgwood. If this really is a war of intelligence, a war of information, is it really going to be won by better technical and better technological intelligence gathering capabilities? And should, in fact, these things really be the focus, and that all this legal stuff, I mean, I know this is a legal panel, this is what we're here to talk about, but should that stuff really be the focus, and that all these changes to habeas corpus and all these sort of proposed potential infringements, should these really be subsidiary concerns, and is it sort of a possible shortcut that we're looking at doing here, and in fact, the focus should really be on these sort of technical, technological aspects more.
Well, you raise a very interesting point. The question really is not so much whether we're going to win the war on terrorism, but whether we're going to defeat the ability of terrorists and other people to use the capabilities that are out there around the world. I teach a class called Transnational Threats and International Law, which covers all of the different types of things that we see today, from terrorism to environmental crimes. And the fundamental similarity to all of the threats is the ability of the bad actor to use money laundering, to use the internet, to use halawas, you know, anything like this, basically boils down to either organized crime or the techniques of organized crime. And so the question you ask, I think, is a very good one, because we may be able to wipe out al-Qaeda. We will not be successful in wiping out the threat unless we can eliminate the ability to, for example, transfer money around the world anonymously and things of a similar nature.
I quite agree that this is probably the tail wagging the dog. It's an attempt to put the dike, finger back in the dike while other things are worked on. Lots of funny ideas, interesting ideas. I wonder whether you can't spoof fatwas. What is it that's so idiosyncratic about the syntax and mellifluousness of a particular fatwa that you can't do what once upon a time had been wretchedly called co-intel-bro. But if you're having a civil war within Islam, why can't you make some noise? There's an interesting thought out there of teaching computer programs to look for particular markers of stridency. So if you were capturing reams of document or reading millions of web pages, could you just select the ones that ought to then be read by a human being who has more discernment, but have a machine first give you the initial calling? A lot of it's going to be clearly bolstering the moral self-confidence of Islam moderates, so they don't fear assassination, so they realize there are others out there. If extremists can organize by internet, so can moderates. So I think some of the reaction you've now seen to the Madrid bombing and the London bombings and may finally reawaken the voice of moderate Muslims within Europe. Part of it's our own wild, feckless libertarianism, too. Again, we were overhearing, I saw by the newspapers, Bin Laden just fine until a certain story in a certain paper that's published in New York City may or may not have mentioned that we were overhearing Bin Laden, and then I shut down. And this is going to sound extremely tendentious, so forgive me, but I used to be a Harvard Crimson reporter, so I had imbued within me the prerogatives of the First Amendment, but some of it may require a degree of self-restraint by responsible publishers if they happen to hit upon a technological goldmine that will cause catastrophic consequence, which is something we're not used to doing. So there are particular difficulties that we have that make it harder, I think, for the Bureau to get ahead of the career ones.
One last question. Yes, sir.
Patterson. Would you comment on the assertion that the commission approach was simply a political choice, a politically controllable choice, that would serve to intimidate and perhaps deter, and that if we had wanted to demonstrate an interest in justice and an interest in setting a democratic example around the world, that we would have picked up the now quite robust court martial procedures?
Well, I guess if the goal was to deter, because we were using the military commission process, that goal has failed, because we have yet to successfully prosecute anybody. I think that the military commission process was chosen because those who chose it initially felt as if we were going to engage in very quick and swift justice. The military commission process was modeled on the N. Ray Quirin case, leaving aside and ignoring the fact that there's been a substantial development in military justice in the last 50 years, that we're not doing the same thing under the UCMJ that we were doing 50 years ago. If you take a look at the UCMJ, it essentially parallels the federal system. There aren't very many differences. But I don't think that the military commission process was used to frighten or deter. I think that the military commission process was used because the administration didn't want to afford POW status to Al-Qaeda and Taliban personnel. If you afforded them POW status under specific provisions of the Third Convention, 84 and 102, you're internationally obligated to try them under the court-martial system, i.e. the same judicial system by which your own personnel are tried. They didn't want to do that. And so I think that's one of the basic reasons why the military commission process was used. You can argue which came first, the chicken or the egg. But I don't think deterrence really entered into it. I think that it was chosen because they thought it would be swift, they thought it would be sure, and they wouldn't be faced with a lot of the procedural obstacles that they would have been faced with in federal district court.
Let me thank all of you for an absolutely superb discussion this evening, and please join me in thanking our panelists. There is a reception that will follow. I gather we have lots of refreshments. You're most welcome to join us.